Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address given at the 3rd Annual Nebraska Children's Health Summit at Boys Town National Headquarters. The summit was co-hosted by Boys Town National Research Hospital, Building Bright Futures, Creighton University, the Nebraska State Education Association, the University of Nebraska Medical Center, the Urban League of Nebraska, and the Nebraska Child Health Care Alliance. The guest speaker will be Martin O'Malley, the governor of the state of Maryland. The topic of his talk will be children, health care, and schools. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, December 12, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsoring organizations, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program and the speaker is John Cavanaugh, Executive Director of the Building Bright Futures Board of Directors.
I want to start by thanking Father Bays for and Boys Town for hosting this very important event. We call it a summit. It's our third year of bringing together the health leadership of the state and the education leadership of the state, and we have a tremendous representation across the board. I want to thank Boys Town not only for hosting this event, Father, but for your 95 years of service to the youth of this country and really leadership across the country in terms of youth issues and health issues. It's a perfect combination for what our challenge is going forward, which in this state it has been a challenge to bring together health leadership and education leadership for the betterment of youth and families. But Boys Town has been a model, as have the other co-sponsors of this event. And the University of Nebraska Medical Center has been a tremendous force in this state for meeting the needs of high-risk families and providing leadership across the state in terms of health care. The Urban League, which is a partner and a co-sponsor with us, is doing tremendous work to provide leadership in our community for children in need. And this year we have the Nebraska State Education Association, and you did see the participation of the School Boards Association, and bringing together the leadership of the school boards and the dedication of our teachers across the state is a critical element to raising the quality of both health care and education, and we are making great progress in that effort. Creighton University and Dean Zetterman reminded us of the moral imperative that is involved here in our expansion of Medicaid in the state of Nebraska, and it's a moral imperative that involves all of us. I want to take a moment to also recognize some of the leadership who is here, starting with Senator Kathy Campbell, who is truly a hero in this state for her leadership in restoring prenatal care in the last session of legislation. And she chases even greater challenges in the coming session. But she's going to have the help of Senator Jeremy Nordquist, who also contributed to the organizing this event. Thank you, Jeremy, for all you've done here. Senator Heath Mello will be a dynamic leader in the coming session. Senator Rick Kowalski, who we all saw this morning in his maiden voyage here, did a tremendous job, and we're looking forward to your leadership in the coming session, Senator. We also have two great leaders in education, Rebecca Valdez, who is a current member of the Nebraska State Board of Education, and Rebecca here, she was here, And a new member, Dr. Rachel Wise, an alumni. We are looking forward to her transforming the Nebraska Department of Education. We also had Lorraine Chang, the chairman of the learning community, and I think Lorraine had to leave, but we're pleased to have her here. And we do have Scott Adams of the Department of Health and Human Services, who's long been dedicated to youth and children in our state. Scott. And Omaha City Councilman Pete Festerson, who's not only a city councilman, but a leader in terms of early childhood education. And I want to thank all of those participants and many, many more. I want to thank the members of our panel who all did an outstanding job. And now I want to thank my old friend, Governor Martin O'Malley, for getting up early and traveling out to Nebraska to see us. I've known Martin for 35 years, maybe. I met him as a, he was a college dropout. And so he knows the challenges of education. He dropped out of college to work on a presidential campaign, and we worked together on that. And I think I inspired him to go back to school and make something of himself. And he's turned out just fine. Martin is really being recognized as one of the truly outstanding governors of our 50 states. And what he has accomplished since his election in 2006 in the state of Maryland is really phenomenal and is a guide and a beacon for where other states want to be, and particularly Nebraska. The priorities that Maryland has made in terms of children, youth, and families are exactly aligned with what we know we must do in order to be successful. And beginning with early childhood and a tremendous commitment, first of all, to quality standards for child care, which is going to be one of the major items that Fawn Taylor outlined for us earlier, combined with effective measures of kindergarten readiness, are essential to assure that our children get off to an early start and a successful start in their educational pursuit. And marrying that commitment to access to quality care is an essential component that Maryland is leading the country on, and was the reason that we asked Governor O'Malley to be here, is that for the past 4 years, Maryland has led the country number one in educational outcomes in terms of improving test scores and academic performance across the board, beginning with early childhood, beginning with kindergarten readiness, and following that all the way through post-secondary education. They've become a model for the rest of us to follow. Martin is also a successful father. His wife, Katie, have four children, and they're all doing well, I presume, Martin.
So far,
and for Father Bays, I want to reiterate that Martin is a member of St. Francis of Assisi Parish, so he comes fully credentialed across the board. But it is a great pleasure to have Governor O'Malley here, and I want to have you all give him a warm welcome that he deserves for getting up so early to join us this afternoon.
Thank you very, very much. What a kind welcome. Governor Ed Rendell used to say to me, everybody likes their neighboring governor much better than their own. That's a phenomenon of American politics. But John, thank you for your introduction, and thank you for your friendship, and thank you for your inspiration. In addition to inspiring me, Father, to go back to college, John, in a very real way, inspired me to you know, take the step and even volunteer to run for office years later. You know, it's we don't know, John, just how much we're affecting other people in these encounters in the world. But John Kavanaugh is, in the short time that he represented Nebraska in Congress, had the remarkable distinction of probably being one of the most admired and well-liked Congress people there, and it's because of his decency, and you all see that as well. It's good to see some old friends. Michael Yanni, is Michael here? He's coming. Okay, look forward to meeting Michael and everybody with Building Bright Futures, and all the members of the Alliance. Senator Campbell, congratulations on your accomplishment, and to the other distinguished senators here, Senator Mello, Senator Nordquist, and Senator Kolowski. Senator Kolowski, I should know that name. I'm from Baltimore. There are lots of people with that name in Baltimore. Senator Kolowski, and also Councilman Festersen, good to see you, and to know of your Maryland connection. I had occasion to sit and spend a little bit of time talking with Father Bays and his really committed friends over there at Boydstown. I had occasion to meet one of my boys from Maryland who appears to be doing much better, Father. He seemed to be wide awake and looking forward. So thank you so much for the time. We were speaking a similar language, all about performance measures and goals and the earlier interventions and the sort of benefits that it has. And I think at the heart of that conversation is really the heart of the few remarks I have to share with you. And then hopefully we'll open it up so I can steal some of your good ideas and take them home. In our administration, we're kleptocrats. We believe in stealing good ideas from wherever we possibly can. And one of the benefits that comes from visiting with other people wrestling with these big issues, and this is a big issue, improving health outcomes, improving educational outcomes for kids all across your state. I mean, there are some issues that are so big, the only way we're possibly going to tackle them is to do it together. And so I look forward to hearing about the things that you're doing and your approaches and bringing it home. It's wonderful to be back in Nebraska. Been here a couple times over the last couple of years. And I'm sure you probably get this a lot, but one of my favorite, what we old people call albums, what the young people call zip drives, I guess now, what I used to call CDs, one of my favorite collections of original music was Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska album. And the last track, or the last line on the last track of that album, anybody know? Bruce Springsteen for 50? No? Was that song Reason to Believe. Still at the end of every hard working day, people find some reason to believe. Well, I've found lots of reasons to believe, and most of them have come from the good people I've had the honor to serve as a councilman in the city of Baltimore, and then elected mayor of Baltimore in the same year that we had the dubious distinction of becoming the most addicted, violent, and abandoned city in America. And then when I was demoted after being mayor to the office of governor, the people I serve throughout Maryland have given me a lot of reasons to believe. Baltimore's now achieved over the last 10 years the biggest reduction in Part 1 crime of any of the major cities with more than 500,000 people, any of the major cities in America. In the state of Maryland now, we've driven down violent crime to record lows. We haven't seen since we started recording crimes by a standard measure. This year, we've achieved a 30%, knock on wood, reduction in juvenile homicides. In the middle of the recession, we were named the number one schools in America, and we held on to that for these 4 years in a row, as you kindly mentioned, John. We were the only state to go 4 years in a row without a penny's increase to college tuition, and therefore we've, according to College Bound, done a better job of holding down college tuition costs, stated another way, made college more affordable for more families, done a better job of that than any other state in America in these tough times. Those things that I mentioned were not accidents. They didn't just happen because we just happened to be Maryland. They happened because we took the actions together to make them happen. And that's what I wanted to talk with you about today as we kind of focus in on health and early childhood education and the way those things are connected. I think maybe since the time of Descartes, we've been moving towards specialization and silos. If only we learn that unique thing that nobody else knows and we stay within our silo. Increasingly now we realize as human reflection, doubles back on itself like the curvature of the earth, that all of these things are connected and that we really can't expect to focus on just one thing and achieve what we hope to achieve, whether it's on violent crime or educational outcomes or health outcomes or even in creating a more sustainable way of life, without being cognizant of how it fits in the constellation of other things, how we fit. And fueling all of our progress have been some pretty fundamental beliefs. A belief in the dignity of every individual, a belief in our own responsibility to advance the common good, and an understanding that we're all in this together, that there is a unity to spirit and matter, that what we do in our own lifetimes does matter, and that what we do together can make the future a much better place for a lot of people. And so let me dive in, shall I? Providing quality health and dental care for our kids, building better schools, improving outcomes, creating a more sustainable way of life, creating jobs, expanding opportunities, all of these things are connected, and progress on one requires progress on all. And so in response to the question, don't tell me what you believe, tell me what you're doing, because our time is limited, let me tell you what we're doing and what we have done. First, a word on performance measurement. Performance measurement is really our modus operandi. We measure everything. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So the things that are measured are the things that get done. There's a book written a couple years ago by a man named Jeffrey Sachs, who was an advisor to Kofi Annan, and it's called The Price of Civilization. And in this great little book, Jeffrey Sachs writes about the prescription for more effective governance, especially now in this information age, where we really do have the data, and it's more accessible than it's ever been, and it doesn't require a team of 3,000 people to crunch it. What Jeff Sachs says, it gives this prescription. He says, set clear goals and benchmarks, mobilize expertise, make multi-year plans, be mindful of the far future. So for us as Americans, that means beyond this first quarter, right? Be mindful of the far future and restore public management. In our state, we choose to set goals openly and publicly, and we put deadlines to those goals, like reducing violent crime by 20% by the end of 2012. And there's lots of people in politics who think that that's not a wise thing to do because you might not hit your goal. And to those very, very smart people that advise us as we run for office and encourage us to win elections and not have anything on our list that we didn't accomplish, I would respond that people figure it out. If you only get three-quarters of the way to the goal that you hit, most people are pretty damn impressed that you even had the guts to set a goal. And the other thing that the setting of goals does for us is it lets everybody know. I mean, everybody knows when everybody knows. And if everybody knows what everybody knows and when it's expected, then everybody can work together in a much more coordinated fashion. Seems like a small thing, but setting goals is critically important. We measure our progress. We broadly share information rather than hoarding it. And when necessary, we change course in order to move our graphs in the right direction. We have 15 overarching strategic goals for our state. Number one goal, jobs. Job salvation, job creation. There is no progress without a job. But then there's 14 other goals. They're all connected. They're all mutually reinforcing. And so I'm going to dig into just a couple of them. Second only, I think, to the jobs goal. In fact, I think it is the second strategic goal. I'm the generalist in the family, by the way. When we open it up to conversation, I told John I reserved the right to consult Steve, who will consult the state satellite for greater details. But the second goal is the goal of improving student achievement and school, college, and career readiness by 25% by the end of 2015. And we set that goal back in 2007. In the aggregate, we're actually at a 27% improvement. In the aggregate, we're falling and not succeeding where CTE is concerned, but in some others, we are over attaining. Progress to a goal as overarching as that large goal. Let me say it again. In improving student achievement and school, college, and career readiness by 25% by 2015 also happens to be related to many of the other goals. We drive to that goal also by driving towards another strategic goal, which is the eradication of childhood hunger in our state by 2015. And one of the leading actions on that being school breakfast, and we can get into that later in the Q&A. And by golly, if you have some A for answers, well, I want you to raise your hand first. It's advanced by another strategic goal, which is our goal to reduce violent crime by 20%, crimes against women and children by 25%. And because so many of the so many of the outcomes for kids are connected to the time, quality time that they spend with their parents. In a way, our effort to double public transit ridership and reduce traffic congestion is, in a way, also connected. So, look, that's we measure goals, we put deadlines on them, and the things that get measured are the things that get done. So during the time I've had the honor to serve the people of Baltimore as their mayor, we've had to address several connected public health challenges that were impacting our kids' ability to reach their full potential. We did not have the power to expand Medicaid, as we do at the state level, and now to expand it greatly, but we did have the power to do some other things. Our city, as I mentioned, had become the most violent, addicted city in the United States of America, and I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of how we turned that around. We borrowed strategies from the NYPD, a performance measurement, CompStat, putting the cops on the dots, anticipating where crime was going to happen. We also, with its basic principles of timely, accurate information shared by all, rapid deployment of resources, effective tactics and strategies, and relentless follow-up. And we weren't satisfied with just doing that in the police department. We also did it across all endeavors of city government. And city or CompStat morphed or evolved into CityStat. And CityStat has now evolved into StateStat. And I don't know how you would ever run an organization as complicated as municipal government of any size or a state of any size without having the dashboards and the performance metrics and doing it every day, in every way, forcing people to meet every 2 weeks, not once a year, to prepare your budget. I don't know how you run anything as large as a government effectively without doing that, which brings me to another challenge that I just want to highlight by way of illustration. In addition to persuading the governor at the time to double what our state did on drug treatment, which helped us greatly, helped us save a lot of lives, and also helped fuel that violent crime reduction. We also found one other insidious thing that people had gotten used to in our city, and this is one that is connected both to health outcomes of kids and also to their educational outcomes. And it was the epidemic, really, that some of our older neighborhoods where some of our poorest families lived had come to accept the fact of some pretty high and chronic levels of lead paint poisoning of our kids. And it had gone on for years and years, decades and decades. And we shrugged our shoulders and collectively said, well, that's just Baltimore. There's nothing you can do about that. There's their old houses. We created a collaborative offshoot of our various departmental staffs, that we called Lead Stat. And we started running plays. We broke down the silos. We focused on the goal. We knew that it had been proven to impair the development of the brain and the nervous system in kids, therefore children's ability to succeed in school or even sit still in school or even concentrate at all in school. So the way we addressed the challenge was kind of multifaceted. Instead of just having a small group of people at the health department that were qualified to inspect for lead, we cross-trained people in the housing department. We also trained firefighters. Any of you in municipal government, people are very loath to open their house to anybody from government unless they're a firefighter. So we trained firefighters as well. So we were doing a lot more inspections in homes for lead. We stepped up enforcement of lead paint violations. We went to universal testing of all kids in the city by the pediatricians for heightened levels of lead. And then we get into that home right away to address the challenges, which often, you know, they were rental properties. And we also purchased do-it-yourself home lead dust test kits for every expecting mom in Baltimore. We launched an advertising campaign aimed at mass transit riders, encouraging them to protect your children against lead poisoning. And we mapped all of our opportunities to save the potential of so many young children. In other words, we put all the dots on the map of wherever the the challenges were, where the violations were. We relentlessly followed up. And the wonderful thing about a map is a map doesn't know whether a neighborhood is black or white or rich or poor or Democratic or Republican. Actually, we have other maps, John, that tell us whether they're Democratic or Republican. But the map tells you where to focus, and then you follow up, and you continue to follow up. And you might not be able to lick the problem in just 1 week, but if you do a little better every week, you'd be surprised when you look over your shoulder how much progress has actually been made. We were strategic. We targeted our resources, and working together with the people of our city, we succeeded in reducing the number of children exposed to high levels of lead by 73% in just about a 10-year period of time. Today, lead poisoning is down in the city of Baltimore 92% compared to 1999. So, that's one kind of ship in the bottle example, but there's not a doubt in my mind that part of the reason why test scores have been rising in the city of Baltimore, where, again, we thought, well, it's just Baltimore, the schools will always be underperforming. Part of the reason is the kids are healthier. There are 92% fewer kids that have lead today than had it 10 years ago. And at the state level, we went on to pass bills to protect children from exposure to lead in toys and other things. Statewide, we've now reduced lead poisoning statewide by more than 98% compared to where it was two decades ago. But again, the main driver in all of that was the city of Baltimore. In 1999, when I ran for mayor, and this gets into the education as I transition here from health to education and back and forth, there was just one full-day pre-kindergarten class in the entire city of Baltimore. Only 41% of our students were in full-day kindergarten, and I think that 41%, Steve, is a statewide number rather than a citywide number. Even in a difficult fiscal climate, you know, we chose to increase our investments, and we went from one full-day pre-K class now to 90. We've invested to move our entire city now to full-day kindergarten. In fact, the entire state went to full-day kindergarten thanks to state efforts to address what had been an inequitable funding system, where so we had the state step up more in that. But one of the biggest benefits, and I saw it happen before my very eyes, was the way our kids started improving their test scores with that first cohort of children in the city of Baltimore that had the benefit of full-day kindergarten. You could just see the tide immediately go up, and it continued to stay up. When I was mayor, not one grade scored majority proficient in reading or math in the entire city when I was elected mayor. 10 years later, grades 1 through 8 are majority proficient in reading, and grades 1 through 7 are majority proficient in math. And I am absolutely convinced that full-day kindergarten was a big piece of that progress. The first all-day kindergarten, the results are pretty dramatic. The first all-day kindergarten class went on to score 61% higher on their third grade reading levels than the class right before them that did not have full-day kindergarten, and 35% higher on their math than the class just ahead of them that did not have the benefit of full-day kindergarten. Their progress continued throughout their development. In eighth grade, they scored 26% higher on reading than that class ahead of them, and in math, 37% higher than that class just ahead of them that did not have the benefit of full-day kindergarten. So I have become, I'm not an ideologue, I'm for whatever works, and full-day kindergarten works, and I've seen it happen. And so at the state level, we have now made pre-K and full-day kindergarten priorities. We've invested to bring our state to 100% full-day kindergarten. We're investing 28% more on pre-K education than what we were doing back in 2007, even as we've cut and cut and cut and cut most everything else. In addition, we're credentialing and accrediting seven times as many early education providers now than we were 10 years ago. And this is an important development. We stopped looking at pre-K as something that was we stopped looking at it as a babysitting service, and we looked at it as an important educational endeavor. And if there's an important educational endeavor, then you have to have standards, you have to have accreditation. And so we put it under the So it's still a work in progress, but it is a work that is overseen now by our state school superintendent. It is an education function. And we're reaching out to parents also to help educate mom and dads on how to better prepare their own kids for entering school so that they can. We had a whole awareness campaign, Ready to Learn. Science tells us 90% of the human brain development is completed by age three. So it's so critically important to everything that these kids go on to do. We also know that the earlier you invest, and this is particularly true with kids that have developmental challenges, the earlier intervention is really key there. So our infants and toddlers program that focuses on kids with developmental challenges, we greatly increased funding on that score, even, again, as we were cutting other things. I think a 79% increase is what my notes say on the infants and toddlers program. On the healthcare side of the equation, we've expanded access to healthcare now for 360,000 people that did not have it before, and 164,000 of them are children. Now, how did we do that? We doubled the tobacco tax so we could cover and expand coverage. At the same time, we've also eliminated the red tape of the face-to-face interviews. We made enrollment easier. We've allowed local health departments to accept families' applications. We've also vastly expanded dental services for vulnerable kids. We had a very tragic incident, Father, where a little boy named Devontae Driver died because his mother was unable to take him to get the toothache addressed. And then that infection spread to his brain, and tragically the little boy died because he couldn't go see a dentist. And so we used that tragedy to galvanize the consensus necessary to expand our efforts where dental is concerned. The Pew Foundation ranks us number one in oral access for kids now in the country, and we were really, really bad just a few years ago, so I'll be damned. Some of these programs actually make a difference. And we're also working, as I said, to become the first state to eradicate childhood hunger. Maybe we'll want to get into that a little bit later. Kind of hard to expect a little kid to learn reading and math if he hasn't anything to eat since the school lunch the day before. So last but not least, we believe in Maryland that to truly give our kids a healthy start, we have to find ways to reconnect them with nature and the outdoors. Who was it from Boys Town on the way over here shared a beautiful saying, which is that beauty is a silent teacher? Is that the saying? Beauty is a silent teacher. So we have an effort underway called Children in Nature, and we're getting more of our kids into nature. and a lot of them are kids who live in very concrete neighborhoods where they're lucky to see a tree, let alone a forest. And we became the first state in America now to make environmental literacy a high school graduation requirement. So anyway, that's a lot that I've just thrown at you. Maybe we'll learn more from each other when we have a conversation here. I guess the main point is that all of these things are connected, and the actions that we take are connected. And when taken together in pursuit of a goal, then that goal is to give our kids a happier and healthier start, we can actually succeed and we can actually move forward. One last performance measure. Last year, 83% of our kindergartners entered school fully ready to learn. 83%. That is some. And that's up appreciably from like 60% just a few years back. In Maryland, we consider ourselves to be pro-growth Americans. And by that, I mean that we believe in growing jobs and growing opportunity, and we believe in children growing strong and growing healthy and growing ever more educated. We believe in grandparents growing old with dignity and with love and respect. We believe in growing trees and growing more sustainable bay fisheries and growing food locally in order to help our environment and our economy. And we also believe in growing in other ways, growing in our appreciation of one another, growing in our compassion for one another, growing in our understanding that the things that we do actually matter, and that together we can take actions that matter a great deal, not just for our generation, but for the generations that will come after us. I truly believe that for many reasons, some related to technology, others related to the urgency of the challenges before us, that we are at the threshold of a new era of progress in our country. Setting goals, measuring performance, bringing the collective wisdom that all of us bring to the table to bear and taking action on the faith that there are plenty of reasons to believe that tomorrow can be better than today. Thanks so much for. Questions and answers. And if you have the answers, you go first. All right, then let's get to questions. We always in the back, yes, ma'am.
What I wanted to ask about is the involvement of families and particularly how you get buy-in from especially the parents and the rest of the families. I work with the high schools here, and I know that a lot of the issue when families are struggling and limited time and resources and everything, how do you get them to take that agency and buy in into the child and their success rather than kind of being like some of the families that I see that say, you know, oh, that's not my child or not my problem, that think that someone else is going to take over for that. How do you get them to buy in or take that agency and participating in that process?
Well, it's an ongoing, harder in some places than in others, but I'm trying to think of some examples here. One of our other strategic goals is the reduction of infant mortality in our state. And so far, we had hoped to knock that down. I think our goal was, what, Steve, 10% by 12? And I think we're at 16%. And part of the reason, and part of the way we've done it, is by reaching out to the families. A lot of the wraparound services, having teams of people, especially in the city of Baltimore, to go out and visit expecting moms in their homes
not asking them to transfer to two buses and come down and find the 17th floor of the DSS building downtown after spinning around three times, standing on their head, gargling peanut butter, whistling Dixie. You know, you have to make it, you have to go to where people are. Who was the guy that said, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. We will go to where the expectant moms are. And we did some other things as well. But, I mean, we have there's an initiative that we launched about 5 years ago called Place Matters. And we do that in our Department of Social Services. And we've had tremendous success in bringing down the number of kids that are placed in foster care or the out-of-home placement. So we try to restore the home. And the most important place in our state is a family's home. And I don't know that there's any magic to it. I do know that less outreach is not the answer. And I know that less conversations and dialogues is not the answer. So we've had success in more outreach and more dialogues and targeting out there. I mean, I think we... Did any of that make any sense? I guess our approach is... When we look at these big challenges in health and in behavioral health, I mean, I guess our first question is, what can we do to strengthen that home? Not how quickly can we, or in juvenile things, get that kid out of the home. So that's what we ask ourselves, and that's true. That was true in the lead stuff as well. You know, we got to get into the home. And I've been blessed. I've had some great public health professionals, and Dr. Bielenson, and now Dr. Sharfstein, both at the city and then at the state level. And so, you know, it's all about the outreach and doing the work. There's no substitution for getting knowledgeable, caring people into the home, you know, whatever the health challenge is. And preferably they're dressed as firefighters. Yes.
Can you give us some examples of how you got the business community and the private sector involved in some of these initiatives? Because Nebraska is very different in the way that we operate, and that we feel that's very important. I think to make change happen, it's going to have to come with that buy-in as well.
Sure. The efforts on the Ready to Learn actually came about through a coalition of a lot of nonprofits in the city of Baltimore. Casey Foundation being probably first among equals there, but there were many that came together in a coalition. We're really pushing the Ready to Learn initiative. When we had to pass the school funding bill, Thornton, we had real disparate funding that was based on the ability of a jurisdiction's property tax rate to pay. And so, as you might imagine, City of Baltimore, you know, was not able to invest the same amount of dollars that the more affluent counties were. So when we stepped up in that, a big part of the thrust, there were a lot of business people urging the equitable funding and the Thornton formula. There was a lot of preparation that went into a bit of a roadshow, if you will, going around and having sort of town halls and having respected people on the commission, and the advocates and the nonprofits were certainly pushing the full-day kindergarten. I suppose one of the more unique and interesting experiences with getting people broadly motivated, including the business community, happened with our Believe campaign in the city of Baltimore. It's a long story, and I'll give you the Cliff Note version of it. After a year of more effectively running our city government, more effectively running our police department, and seeing our ability to actually drive crime below 300 homicides for the first time in 20 years, we had the opportunity to galvanize broader consensus that we knew we would need, and also galvanize the business community. We wanted them to to see that Baltimore was a place that was on the rebound, not a place where last person out, turn off the lights. And we did that with we raised from our business community probably about $2 million, which was a lot of money. And we put a lot of that on the air with a campaign called Believe. And we ran a very graphic and jarring 5-minute commercial that followed a little African-American boy through his life in a very drug-ravaged and violent crime-plagued neighborhood of our city, like sadly too many of them. And the little boy, the ad begins with the little boy saying, you know, my grandmother says we're all part of one big fire. I don't know if that's true, but I know that there's a fire inside of me. And meanwhile, you know, there's an addicted man on the corner warming his hands on an open fire. And then you kind of travel with this little boy through his day, through these guys from the county think I'm a drug dealer already. I don't want any part of that. And they're motioning to the little boy, you know, past the prostitution and the dealers and everything, and the abandonment and everything that goes with it. And then as the music starts to shift and the camera goes down a long street to flashing lights and a crowd gathered there, but you hear the boy say, my sister's gone to the store to buy some candy. I wonder what's keeping her. And then as the camera gets down to that place, it focuses on this adorable little African-American girl with her tightly braided hair lying dead in a pool of blood with her lifeless eyes wide open. And then the narrator says, the city of Baltimore's in a fight. It's a fight for our future. It's a fight that we've been losing one life at a time. And as the camera flashes on black and white faces, police and civilian, he says, there are some people who say it's over. Give up. We've lost. But for the strong, for the brave, this fight is not over. And then you see this little boy just as the red, you know, siren light kind of flashes slowly over his face. You see him looking right at you through the TV screen like, what are you going to do about this? And then it ends as it began, you know, with the little boy saying, please don't let the fire go out. And then stark white on black, the word comes up, believe. Believe in yourself. Believe in us. Baltimore. Believe. And we ran those very uncomfortable ads and then a smaller one, like a 30-second reminder ad, for 2 weeks, and the business community was not pleased. That's what we did with their money. I said, well, you know, that's the opener. That's the opener. So we did that for 2 weeks, and then we started running individual calls to action. Join the police department, call 1-800-BELIEVE, and they would all end, believe in us, believe in yourself, Baltimore, believe. Mentor a child. An hour a week can save a life. And then we had one sort of like the hair club president. We had a white doctor saying that there's more drug treatment available, that it works. If you know somebody who's suffering from addiction, get them into treatment. It does work. I should know. I myself am a recovering addict. And those each had a 1-800 number. So we recruited a lot of mentors. The applications at the police department went way up when we were having a hard time with recruitment and also the quality of recruits, not to mention the diversity of recruits. And we got a lot of people into drug treatment and continued to drive down overdose deaths. That was a long story, but it was a good one. And the point of it is this. A very, very smart man who helped us with those ads, as smart, you know, people that have a certain gift, they say it like everybody should see it. And he said, you have to acknowledge the shared negative perception before you can lift the shared value to overcome that cynicism or that negative perception. So that's what we did. It wasn't a pleasant couple weeks, but we had to acknowledge the reality, you know, in order to get to the deeper ingrained cultural value from the state that withstood British bombardment in 1814 without even the federal government to back us up. And that was believe. Believe in us. believe in yourself. Believe together we're stronger. So I think the way you get the business community to do it is sort of like that, in your own way. Father.
Governor, one of the things we talked about when you did the tour of the Hall of History is that in the last 5 years, Boys Town's gone from serving 75% of its kids by pulling them out of the home to now 75% with in-home or community-based services. And we think that needs to change across the United States. Instead of spending 75% of our state and federal dollars on pulling kids out to help them at home, how do you see that happening in your state, and how do you think it can happen in ours?
Yeah, I could not agree more. This is very similar to a lot of other things that we do. I mean, if you look at the healthcare debate, I mean, it's the same thing, right? I mean, if people learned how to be well in their homes and, you know, drinking water, breathing, eating better, not smoking, all of those things. And so we have some initiatives going on. I mentioned the one that's called Place Matters. So social services is all about, hey, let's fix the home and let's make sure we develop diagnostic tools that will tell us where our most vulnerable families are so that we can help when they're at the shallow end of the pool instead of having to send a dive team in for them when they're at the deep end of the pool. So that's what we've been doing. A lot of those mentors from that Believe campaign went into a program that we call Baltimore Rising, where we identified those kids that could really benefit from the mentor. And we also have been doing... We also started something called KidStat, where we brought multiple agencies in. You know, confidentiality where kids are concerned. It's the last bastion of bureaucratic scoundrels. It's just a crying shame that we would bury so many kids with so many different departments' fingerprints on their file and nobody ever taking responsibility. And so we're continuing to evolve on that identification. But if you can identify early and keep the kids in the home, it is so much, you know, we were going to have to build a, I probably shouldn't say that here. We were under a court decree to build a new youth jail because our conditions were so deplorable. We think we will be able to build a much smaller youth jail because, like your philosophy, Father, we're moving further upstream, doing the diagnosis and doing the intervention and healing the home and the consolation for the home. So Place Matters is what we call it in DSS. And you can track it and see that we've reduced number of kids that are in foster homes and also increased number of adoptions is another piece of what we've been doing. So those are a couple of things.
Governor, thank you very
much. Thank you, John. Thanks a lot, man. I enjoy it. Thanks. Good to be with you. Thanks.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the keynote address given at the 3rd Annual Nebraska Children's Health Summit at Boys Town National Headquarters. The summit was co-hosted by Boys Town National Research Hospital, Building Bright Futures, Creighton University, the Nebraska State Education Association, the University of Nebraska Medical Center, the Urban League of Nebraska, and the Nebraska Child Health Care Alliance. The guest speaker was Martin O'Malley, the governor of the state of Maryland. He spoke on the topic, children, health care, and schools. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, December 12, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Kathleen Johnson, marketing coordinator at Boys Town National Research Hospital, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.